My name is Dean Baker. I'm the co-director here, and I will be lecturing here tonight next week, and we will have, I gather, many of you here for much of the series. Why we thought it was worth having a seminar series on economics, being in D.C. or being actually anywhere in the country, it's hard not to be frustrated a lot of times by the direction of economic debates. Very often it seems that the liberal progressive side loses before we even get into it, and you know, I'm sure you've all heard the line about Democratic Party strategists, you know, when they order tanks, they always get a version of the model that has five speeds, four in reverse and one forward in case they're attacked from the rear. And that's often what it feels like in these debates, that half the time we're giving up much of the battle before you even enter into it. And a lot of that is simply because I think a lot of people in the debates, a lot of people in the country, aren't aware of some very, very basic economics. So we figured since we waste a lot of our time doing this stuff, we would inflict some of it on you with the idea that, you know, more people, it would be beneficial to have more people on the liberal side, progressive side, with a better grounding in economics, so we don't always get rolled in these debates. Let me just say a couple things about, you know, the format. We're going to try to stick to this having 45 minutes where I lecture, where I talk. Then we'll have a break so you can all run off, do whatever you have to do. Also, I'm going to insist that people don't, that you have your cell phones turned off. It would be a very bad thing to anyone who has a cell phone go off, so please make sure your cell phone is turned off. During the question period, I want to restrict that to questions. So, you know, if you have some grand, profound statement, I'm interested in hearing it, but not during that session. So, well, 45 minutes or so, you know, for questions. And, you know, please try to restrict that to actual questions. Okay. So let me start. Okay, there are four points that I'm calling the basics or keys to good economics. And the first one is what I'll spend most of the time on. And that's always putting numbers in context. All the time we hear numbers that are very often meaningless to people. That's not to our advantage. We want people to know what numbers mean. We have to have them in context. And I'll go through a number of the ways in which they're generally not in context today, but we would like them to be in context. It's to our benefit in context. Stock market's not the economy. This is really a simple, obvious point. Everyone should know this, but I don't know how many times if you turn on the news and you just get, you know, the one, you know, the 10-second blip about the economy. Did the stock market go up? Did the stock market go down? That's not the whole story. It might not even be any of the story. Okay, so I'll just make a couple points about that. The third point, don't let them get away with name calling. Half the time, you know, you're a big spending liberal. You want taxes. You know, you just throw the name out there. You want the government to intervene. You don't want people to stand up. You know, and the whole story is name calling. And we can't let them get away with that, because when we do that, we lose. And the last point is just that, you know, we are right. There is no contradiction between, you know, things that we might care about, eliminating poverty, ensuring that people have basic social needs, that they have health care. We might say that those things would be good even if it did inflict, you know, even if it did cost something. But in fact, you know, there's no evidence very often that that's the case. And the things that the other side wants, that President Bush wants, he wants to always give more tax cuts to his wealthy friends, that hurts the economy. Okay, so we don't have to be defensive. We should know that we're right, because most of the time we are. Okay, starting with context, budget numbers. This is the place where I think it's absolutely most important. All the time, you pick up the newspaper, you listen on television, you hear some debate about budget numbers, about the deficit's going to be $350 billion this year, that we're talking about a tax cut that's, you know, $1.2 trillion, that someone's proposing a spending bill for, let's say we're getting more money for child care, $6 billion. No one has any idea what those numbers mean. And I don't mean just people, I don't mean like, you know, if we go down to Peoria, Illinois, and we, you know, catch someone in the diner there. I don't mean that. It's true, they probably don't know what it means either. But I mean, take people with, you know, very well-educated people. Imagine my brother's a lawyer in Seattle. He doesn't know what those numbers mean. You know, you could get people with college degrees, advanced degrees. Budget wonks know what it means. Maybe a lot of you do know what it means because you're sitting there reading the budget. Okay, but almost no one in the country has any ideas what these numbers mean. And if you took a number that's, you know, that's expressed in millions or billions or trillions, half the time, if you flip that over, you know, if you had a number, if we're talking about Social Security, which I'll come to in a moment, and it's expressed in trillions, half the time, if that were just instead expressed in billions, it wouldn't mean the same thing to people. Okay, people don't know what these numbers mean. Also, half the time, they don't even know whether we're talking about a 5-year budget, 10-year budget. And I've seen news articles. One of the things I do, I'll plug a thing I do, the Economic Reporting Review, is on our website. I do commentary on the economic reporting in the New York Times and Washington Post every week. And half the time, I could be reading through an article, and they'll be talking about a budget bill that's over 6 years, and they'll never mention that. Okay, the transportation bill that was just passed, the $290 billion bill, six-year appropriation. Half the articles you read in the New York Times or Washington Post, I'm signaling them out because they're two of the best papers in the country, half the articles don't even mention the time period over which that spending will take place. And obviously it makes a big difference if you're talking about $290 billion over 1 year, which is about 15% of the budget, or $290 billion over 6 years, which is about 2%, 2.5%. So it makes a very big difference. Okay, well, it's not hard to make these meaningful. Simply express them as a share of the budget. Okay, it's a really, really simple thing to do. Okay. Do this. If you look at items as a share of the budget, what we have here is something that we're familiar with, defense spending. It's $498 billion. This is from CBO numbers, so the most recent, the current year's 2005 defense spending. It comes to a bit over 20% of the budget. It's about 22% of the budget. Now, I put some other items up here just for a basic comparison, because these are things that a lot of us care about that we would, you know, be concerned about, important things. But it's important to realize, what are we talking about here? So temporary assistance to needy families, the reformed welfare program. Okay, that's an appropriation of a bit less than $20 billion. It's less than 1% of the budget. Okay, it's less than one-tenth of what we're spending, less than one-twentieth, I should say, of what we're spending on the military. Child care, $2.1 billion. There was a really big debate around the reauthorization of the TANF Act. Well, I shouldn't say there's been a big debate because we haven't had the reauthorization, but if we ever do get the reauthorization, there is going to be a big debate around an amendment which will increase child care spending by $6 billion over 5 years. That's a really trivial amount of money in terms of the whole budget. Head Start, we still don't fund Head Start to a level where every kid, every poor kid that qualifies it can get it. Okay, which is really, really an amazing story, because, you know, if you look at Head Start, you look at polling on this stuff, Head Start is a tremendously popular program, but we always say we don't have the money. And then you look at how small it is in terms of the whole budget. Now, what's striking is, if you look at polling data on where people think their money is going, they think it's all going for welfare. And you can go back and look at polling data by Pew Center and other places, ask people what are the biggest items in the budget, they'll usually answer welfare and foreign aid. And, you know, you ask them to put a number on it, and people say things like 25-30%. I'm not kidding. I mean, you can look this up. You'll find that. And you know, when I see those numbers, it amazes me that there's as much support for these programs as there actually is. I mean, if I thought we were spending 30% of the budget on TANF, I wouldn't want to spend more. You'd go, we're spending 30% of the budget on TANF. Why would we think it's going to make anyone better off if we spend, you know, 31%, 32%? A reasonable question. I mean, imagine it really were the case that one-third of your tax dollars were going for TANF, and we could still see there's all these poor people, poor kids. We put out the numbers, you know, poverty's up. We're spending all this money. It doesn't seem to be doing anything. Why would you spend more? Okay, also, in terms of, you know, what it does in terms of, just think in terms of your tax dollar. Obviously, you have a lot of middle-income people. Someone with two kids who's earning $60,000, very typical family. You know, they see that, you know, their tax dollars, they think they're all going to welfare. You go to these people and say, you want to spend more? Well, if they really think this is going to be a big hit out of their pocketbook, well, they might say, no, I really need that money. You know, I feel bad for those poor people, but I really need that money. Now, we have a huge thing to overcome, it's a very simple matter of education. You know, just simply if we express these as a percentage of the budget, that would go a very long way if that became the norm. And I'm saying this because this is sort of a personal crusade that I've been on and we've been working on here, actually. We have a plug for our calculator here. I promise I won't be plugging things constantly, but I do have to mention this. We have an online calculator here, so if you have a budget item and you're trying to think of how important it is, you can look it up, but if you want to save a second, you know, you just go to our website, go to the budget calculator, and if it's over 2 years, over 5 years, you just put it in there and you'll see how large it is. And what you'll find, I think, almost invariably is that the programs that we spend a lot of time worrying about that are important end up being a very, very small share of the budget. Okay, so this is a case, I think, clearly where it's crucial to express things in a context, because when people know the context, they're going to agree with us. Okay, next thing in context, deficits. Deficits should always be measured relative to the size of the budget, relative to the size of the economy, because it doesn't mean anything just to say we have a $300 billion deficit. I'm going to say this knowing that a lot of people want to beat up President Bush because we have a $300 billion deficit. And what I'm going to tell you is, well, it's actually not that big. Okay, what you want to ask about is how large is the deficit relative to the size of the economy? Okay, so we can look at the $300 billion deficit today, and it's about 3% of the economy. Obviously, it's going to go up because of Hurricane Katrina, another $150 billion, $200 billion. So we will be talking about a much bigger deficit at the end of the day. But, you know, before that, we're talking about deficits on the order of $300 billion, about 2.7, 2.8% of the economy. Not trivial, but if we go back to the 1980s and go back to 1983, we had a deficit that was equal to 6% of the economy. And the deficit stayed very high, stayed over 4% all through the 80s, and then it got above 5% again in the early 90s. Okay, so the current deficit, the deficit that we were looking at before Hurricane Katrina and the relief effort and the reconstruction that we're going to get from that, was not actually that large. Doesn't mean Bush's tax cuts are a good idea. Doesn't mean his spending increase is a good military spending increase is a good idea. But realistically, you know, can I say that that's a real big deficit? No, it really wasn't. You have to measure it relative to the size of the economy. And the example I use here, you know, if we're talking about borrowing money, you know, if I owed $500,000, that'd be an awful lot for me, given my income assets. If Donald Trump happens in the course of his business to take out a $500,000 loan, he couldn't care less. The guy's got hundreds of millions or billions, I don't know what's fun. So what? He could pay that back. So what you have to always ask about is how large a deficit is that relative to the size of the economy? That's true for the United States. It'd be true for any country. Otherwise, it's just not a meaningful number. Okay, one last point on the deficit, that this is, again, kind of a pet peeve for me. I do a lot of work on Social Security. If we want to count the proper measure of the deficit, we could add in the money borrowed from Social Security, because that is money that will have to be repaid. So currently we're borrowing about $90 billion a year from Social Security. That's money that will have to be repaid. We should add that in. And I should point out, when people say politicians are hiding using the Social Security surplus to hide the deficit, people are familiar with this concept. I'm not using anything, but we have a Social Security surplus this year. We're collecting about $90 billion more in taxes than we're paying out in benefits. So when we say that we have the surplus, it's often said they use the surplus to hide the deficit. I sort of look at this and go, who is hiding the deficit? Every single budget document I know has the measure of the deficit, adding in the amount of money that you borrowed from Social Security. So if there's anyone in this country who is using the Social Security surplus to hide the deficit, it's the reporters who talk about it. It's not the politicians, because at least last time I looked, you know, NBC, CBS, NPR, New York Times, they could print whichever budget number they thought was most appropriate. So no politician has ever used the Social Security surplus to hide the deficit. We've had a lot of reporters that have done it. Okay, but it's not the politicians, because obviously the reporters are free to correct them if they thought it was appropriate to do so. Again, I think the proper measure, at least for many purposes of the deficit, that should say gross deficit, not gross debt, is the deficit that counts as Social Security surplus, which is readily available. So it's not as though anyone, it's arithmetic to get it in any case, but as I say, every single budget document I know of has that number right there. Okay, another item on the deficit. When we talk about, you know, what sort of deficit can we get away with? When is it too large? I was saying a moment ago that the 3% deficit that we're running this year isn't too large. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the question is the size of the debt that we're accumulating, is the size of that debt growing relative to the size of the economy? So again, this is the Donald Trump story. If I'm getting richer, you know, if I run a large deficit this year, but the economy is growing very rapidly, well, that might not be that big a deal. At the end of the day, what we want to know about is our debt, is the amount of debt that we're building up growing more rapidly than the size of the economy. That's going to tell us whether we have a big problem. So if we're building up, we're running a deficit every year, but the economy is growing very rapidly, we're all going to be very rich, shouldn't be a big problem. So that's the key measure that we don't ultimately want to look at, and those numbers are easy to get. This, again, I don't know why I'm going to blame the person who did this. It's actually my fault. But this should say debt to GDP, not deficit. This is Washington, so you have to blame that. But this is my fault. It should say debt, so please cross out deficits and write debt to GDP. And this is ultimately, if we want to ask, you know, are we running deficits in a way that's sustainable? Are we borrowing more money than, you know, we can, you know, in a way that's going to put the economy in jeopardy at some point in the future? And the story that you see, and I emphasize the gross debt, this includes the borrowing from Social Security, includes some other items that aren't worth going into now, but that's at the end of the day what we want to look at is the gross debt. So that's what we owe to Social Security plus what we owe to the public at large. We start out at the end of the war, it would be even higher if we went a little further back to the immediate post-war period. We started out with a very, very high debt for a simple reason that during World War II, we were borrowing like crazy. And again, this is obviously, at least in my mind, a case in which by borrowing was justified. We wanted to fight a war, you know, that was very expensive, and we borrowed a lot of money to pay the cost of that war. So we came off of World War II with a very, very high ratio of debt to GDP. That falls rapidly. So it falls from 94% to 56% in, 10 years from the 50s to the 60s. Falls from 56% to 37% over the next decade, 60s to 70s. Continues to fall to 1980, 33%. Now, one of the things that's worth noting about this, if I actually put up the deficits for those years, we had a deficit almost every single year in that period. Okay, there are very few years, if you go back over the post-war period, there are very, very few years where we had a surplus. But yet the ratio of debt to GDP fell almost continuously from the end of World War II until 1980. And the reason was very simple. We were borrowing more money, but the economy was growing much more rapidly than the rate at which we were borrowing money. So in other words, we're running deficits in the 70s, yet a lot of people were really concerned about that, thought it was a really big deal at the time. In fact, we could have run deficits like that literally forever, okay, because the ratio of debt to GDP was actually falling. Okay, that turns around in the 80s. Okay, what happens in 1980, of course, is we get Ronald Reagan in the White House, and we get big tax cuts. We also get big increases in military spending. So we get a big run-up in debt in the 1980s, 1990s, actually a lot is concealed there. Most of you, were around here in the 90s or following politics. 1990s, we actually continued to run up a lot of debt in the first part of the decade. Okay, so during 91, 92, 93, we were still running up debt. That ratio still would have been growing. Then we had tax increases. We had budget cuts. And the debt to GDP ratio actually fell in the second half of the decade. This obviously doesn't show up here because I simply have 1990s. Okay, but the basic story of the 90s was sort of two very different pictures. At the start of the 90s, we were running up a lot of debt. By the end of the decade, we actually were seeing a decline in our debt-to-GDP ratio. It doesn't show up there, but you can take the last part, 2000 to 2005. We see, again, if we focus on the gross debt, you see the story very clearly. We go from 58% to 65.7%. That's a fairly rapid run-up in the debt and, the debt-to-GDP ratio. And again, you could do the arithmetic yourself. Obviously, if you keep going at that pace, you get to very high debt-to-GDP ratios before very long. So it's easy to look at that and say, that's not sustainable. Clearly, we could get up to a debt-to-GDP ratio of 70, 75, 80, but somewhere you get to a situation where you get to be a country that your credit just isn't very good because you owe so much money that, it gets a problem. People don't want to lend it back. We're not at that point yet. I don't want to scare anyone that, someone about to think that the U.S. government's going to default. On the other hand, if you keep running up very large deficits, then you do get to that point. That won't be a pretty picture. But the long and short is, when we talk about deficits, we talk about debt. The only way to make sense of them is to put it in context to talk about relative to the size of the economy, because otherwise it's just not a meaningful number. Okay, the next item to put in context, Social Security. I'll try to restrain myself because I spend a lot of time talking on Social Security and I could go on all evening on that, but I'll try to just make a couple key points. Because this really is a case where putting numbers in context is tremendously important. The $12 trillion shortfall, I've debated this all over the country, and almost invariably I'm opposite someone from, Cato or Heritage or Republican member of Congress or staffer, and they almost invariably go, we're facing a $12 trillion, and they always tell people that's trillion with a T. I guess they don't know how to spell trillion, but obviously it's just a scare tactic. I mean, what on earth does that mean? What does this mean to people? Why don't they just say a really big number? They're just trying to scare people. Just to go off a little bit on where this comes from. Most of this projected shortfall, actually, if you look at where it comes from, it's after 2100. We're talking about the 22nd, 23rd, 24th century. My reason for making this point is, you come out with this number, $12 trillion. No one has any idea what that means, and I think anyone would rightfully laugh at the idea that we're talking about a debt that we're going to build up from this program over 100 years from now. I mean, obviously, someone's going to do something with the program now in the next 100 years. Saying that we have a crisis because somewhere in the next 100 years we'll probably want to do something is kind of nuts. But we've had President Bush, and a lot of people, some of whom aren't totally nuts, going out saying that, $12 trillion shortfall, like that's a serious number. And again, it's just a total joke. Okay, $12 trillion, let's make it a little more serious. if we just look over the 75-year planning period, which sounds pretty long to me, but you know, if you look at the Social Security Trustees Report, they have projections out over a 75-year period. So they project out taxes and benefits over the next 75 years. Seems plenty long to me. They project a $4 trillion shortfall. That could probably still sound scary to people. A lot of money. Okay, well, $4 trillion, let's put it in context. How large is that relative to the size of the economy? Okay, well, over that 75-year period, their $4 trillion shortfall is projected to be equal to about 7/10 of 1%. I'm sorry, 7/10 of 1% of income, 7/10 of 1% of the size of the economy. In other words, if we wanted to just snap our fingers and go, what would it take to make this go away? If we were to do it entirely by raising taxes, we could have a tax increase that's equal to 70 cents on every $100, and that leaves the program balanced for the 75-year planning horizon. Now, the Congressional Budget Office has somewhat different projections. I'm not going to go into details on the difference of projections, but if we look at the Congressional Budget Office, their projections are that the shortfall is equal to 0.4% of GDP over the planning period, or in other words, 40 cents on every $100 of income. Okay, is that big? Is that small? Well, again, I like to put things in context. So here we have the Congressional Budget Office's estimate of the shortfall, 0.4%. That's what we have on the left. So, you know, if we raise taxes by 0.4%, that would balance Social Security for the 75-year planning horizon. Okay, what do we have to compare it to? Well, the next one over, the increase in defense spending 2001 to 2005. This is the increase in annual spending. Okay, so how much more are we spending this year measured as a percent of GDP than we were spending back in 2001? And the answer is 1%. It's about 1% of GDP. In fact, it's a little more than that if we include all the war-related expenses, but we'll round down and just say 1%. So the increase in defense spending, in annual defense spending, that we've had over the last 4 years is 2.5 times the size of the tax increase we would need to make Social Security solvent for 75 years. You know, I wouldn't say that that's trivial, it's not. But on the other hand, I don't know of anyone running out there saying that, you know, the economy is devastated because of this additional expense that we're paying, you know, an amount equal to 1% GDP, more for defense, more for the military than we did 4 years ago. Okay, so again, I wouldn't minimize that, but I wouldn't say it's wrecking the economy either. And that's 2.5 times what it would take to make Social Security fully solvent. So, you know, the $4 trillion that they jump up and down for, this is 2.5 times as large. The next one over, President Bush's tax cuts, measures a share of GDP, the size of his cumulative tax cuts. We've had, I guess, 3 or 4 at this point. So if you take the cumulative measure of those tax cuts, that's about 2% GDP. Okay, so it's about 5 times the size of the Social Security shortfall. Okay, so again, if the shortfall is a big deal, presumably his tax cuts have to be a much, much bigger deal. The last one, Medicare, if we want to say, you know, what's the real problem in this picture, Medicare is projected to cost much, much more money through time as Social Security. The increases are much more rapid, not because people get older more quickly when they apply for Medicare than Social Security, but because healthcare spending is going through the roof, okay, both public and private sector. Okay, and, you know, if we want a problem you want to jump up and down about, I wouldn't say it's Medicare spending, it's healthcare spending, that would be worth jumping up and down about, but you know, that's almost 6% of GDP. We're talking about a problem that's going to cost about 15 times as much as a Social Security shortfall. Okay, and this is just for Medicare. This doesn't count Medicaid. It doesn't count, you know, private sector healthcare spending. Okay, so it's a little hard when you look at these numbers, it's a little hard to be too concerned about Social Security. Because it's, you know, if we think that's a big deal, what do we think about Medicare? What do we think about healthcare costs? And if you want to talk about playing games and how, you know, the right manages to roll us all the time, what they do absolutely all the time is they go, well, if we look at the cost of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, that's really going to be huge. And that's a great trick, because if we looked at the cost of Medicare, Medicaid, and maintaining Connecticut Avenue, that will really be huge. Okay, and that would make as much sense, because what's driving up Medicare and Medicaid costs are not that we're getting older. I mean, we are, and that's somewhat of a cost. No one paying attention to it, though. We've been getting older for a long time. That's not new. Okay, what's driving up Medicare and Medicaid costs are health care. But no one wants to talk about that, because the prescription drug industry, the health insurance industry, the doctors, the AMA, they have too much power. So instead of talking about health care costs, they want to take away our parents' and our grandparents' Social Security. But the numbers don't support that. this is why I'm a big fan of putting things in. No one who looks at that in their right mind is going to think we have. Okay, next point. I'll try to run through these a little quicker because I don't want to get us all dragged down in this. You need a benchmark. You need to talk about things in context. Economies grow. They create jobs. That's, you know, it's sort of like if I have a tree in my backyard, it's going to be bigger next year than it is this year, you know, unless it got sick or something. You know, so an economy usually grows through time. So to say, you know, we have more jobs today than we did last year, you expect that, you know, unless we're in a recession, and we have recessions, but, you know, but that's really the exception. You expect to have more jobs this year than last year. We expect the economy to be bigger this year than last year. We expect people to have more income this year than last year. That's really not telling us anything. You know, it's just a slight digression. I remember Gerald Ford back in 1975, we were in a very steep recession. It was, at that time at least, the steepest of the post-war period. The unemployment rate was getting up, I think, around 8%. So they came up with the line that more people have jobs today than ever before. And it was a true statement. It was a true statement. More people are unemployed than ever before, but also more people have jobs. Okay, so if you want to be honest, we don't talk about, you know, okay, we have more jobs, we have higher income. The question is the rates of growth. Okay, and this is worth paying attention to, because there's a very, very interesting record here, and I guess I'm old enough I remember this and other people don't, but we should remember this. The economy grew most rapidly. If I put the 50s up, it'd be comparable to the 60s. The economy grew most rapidly back in the 60s and early 70s when a lot of things we liked were going on. When I'm saying a lot of things we liked, most people were doing better. Okay, there was wage growth up and down the income ladder. There was a closing of the gap, black and white income, women and men. Things were going the right way. Okay, not to say 50s and 60s were great, I'm not saying that, but they were going in the right direction. Okay, and what happens in the 70s, well, first off, we get hit with the oil price shocks. So we have slower growth in the 70s. The 80s, we get Reagan. Okay, we get supply-side economics. Okay, where we have tax cuts, rich people should pay less money. We shouldn't have the government trying to, you know, support unions. You know, we have anti-union policies. Deregulate the economy. Don't worry about pollution. Don't worry about the environment. Well, we have considerably slower growth during those years than we did back in the 60s and 70s. And not to say that this is the only measure, but I think a very important measure, median family income. Okay, what is that? That's, if we just take a look at the income for a family in the middle of the income distribution. So we pick a person, pick a family that half the people in the country have a higher income, half the people in the country have a lower income. So it's a good, useful, you know, first shot. You know, how is a typical person doing? Okay, and what you see there is that the median family income did very well. It grew very rapidly in the 60s, 3.6% a year. Okay, so again, adjusted for inflation, so we don't play any games here. You know, so we had 3.6% a year growth in the 60s, 1.6% a year growth, you know, this short period, 69 to 73, till we had the first round of OPEC price increases. Then we get very, very slow median family income growth in this whole 30 or 32 year period now since 1973. Okay, 73 to 80, the main story there is simply the OPEC price increases. Then we get the policies, the Reagan policies in the 1980s, okay, where, you know, they're very consciously designed to shift income upward. And we see on the one hand, median income growth is very weak, overall economic growth is very weak. A 90s, similar story. Okay, 90s would be a little bit better if we just focused on the last 4 years, the 96 to 2000 boom. Those are pretty good years by most measures. Okay, but taking the decade as a whole, there's not a very good story. We get some growth in median family income, but nothing like what we saw in the 60s. Okay, or again, if we went back further in the 50s. And in the last 4 years, we see obviously a very bad picture. Median family income's actually been falling over the last 4 years. Okay, so I think this is important for two reasons. One is just the simple point that we used to have more rapid growth. So, you know, anyone who wants to say that, you know, we're having great growth right now, well, you know, obviously it's better the economy's growing than it's not growing, but 2.8% growth, you know, that doesn't stand out. That's very bad compared to the 60s or 70s and really just since then, just pretty much the average, a little worse than the average. But secondly, if we ask about how the median family's doing, it used to be the case that the typical family, they were seeing income gains along, you know, more or less in step with overall GDP growth. They're growing, their income was rising in step with the economy. What happens is you get to the, particularly the period since 1980, we see very weak median family income growth, even when the economy's doing reasonably well, 3 or 3.1% growth. there's not very much to show for a typical family. I'll throw in one more thing. I don't want to get too far off on this. But even that family income growth that we're seeing, a lot of that is simply due to the fact that we have more workers per family, which is fine. You know, so you have a lot of women entering the labor force, but you'd like to see that wages are going up for that, that their income's going up for that. And they don't have very much to gain for that. Okay, next point. Stock market's not the economy. This is, again, kind of a pet peeve, but I think an important one. All the time, we hear, you know, if you just get the one-minute clip, if you watch the evening news on Fox, I shouldn't pick a single out of Fox, CBS, ABC, it doesn't matter. I don't mean to pick on Fox because they all do the same thing. You know, if they have something on the economy at all, odds are they're going to tell you what the stock market did. Now, they might have nothing, but usually they will tell you that the stock market did. And you go, well, that's wonderful. But what is the stock market? And this isn't like some leftist critique of the stock market. If we, you know, got, you know, your favorite conservative economist, you know, Glenn Hubbard or Bernard Bernanke or, you know, Martin Feldstein, what's the stock market? Well, it's supposed to represent the value of future profits. Okay, that's what it's supposed to be. Okay, so that good that went up, well, three different stories we could tell. Okay, one is that, three basic stories, we can make them more. Okay, three stories we could tell about the stock market going up. One is maybe the economy is growing more rapidly, and profits will go up with the economy. You know, so next year, the year after, everyone sees those are going to be good years. Corporations will get their share, so their profits are going to go up. Okay, fair enough. Second one, well, maybe profits are growing at the expense of wages. Okay, they realize, you know, that Northwestern just broke their union, or it looks like they're going to the mechanics union. So it looks like, you know, they're going to be able to force workers to take pay cuts. You know, so maybe a lot of companies are in that situation. You know, they could use trade, whatever. They're going to force workers to take pay cuts. Well, if profits go up because we could force workers to take pay cuts, that should make the stock market go up. You know, if I own stock, I want the profits. Okay, so that might make the stock market go up. Or also, again, maybe we cut corporate income taxes. Again, you're very happy if, you know, you're General Electric and you have to pay less in taxes. On the other hand, the rest of us, we're either going to see a cut in services or we'll have to pay more. Okay, so it could also be on the tax side. Or the third thing, you know, we could have Alan Greenspan's irrational exuberance. We could have a stock bubble like we did in the late 90s. Okay, so the question is, you know, are these good things? I tell you the stock market went up. Well, if we know it's number one, if we know that that means the economy is growing more rapidly and, you know, corporate profits are going up just as wages are going up and everyone's going to benefit, great. But we don't know that. Okay, it might well be that the stock market's going up because, you know, all these guys on Wall Street are convinced that, you know, they're going to beat up on workers or they're going to have big tax breaks, so the profits are going up. Why is that good? What do we have to celebrate? You know, if we own a lot of stock, we should be celebrating. Okay, and the third point, you know, if it's just irrational exuberance, it's going to burst. You know, why are you happy that you're going to have a really big bubble? Japan had a bubble that was even bigger than ours in the 1980s, and just now they're recovering from it. Okay, so why is that a good thing? Okay, I'll jump ahead. Well, the last point, when you're talking about the stock market, you're talking about, you know, how owners of stock are doing, which more people own stock today than in the past, but the fact is that only about half the public owns any stock at all. And even of that group, if we say, you know, let's make 25,000 the cutoff of the significant holdings, less than a quarter of the population holds even 25,000 in stock. Okay, so the vast majority of the public, you know, they don't own corn. So, you know, you tell them the price of corn went up. The vast majority of the public are not corn producers. Okay, so telling us that the stock market went up only if it's a situation of case one where that's indicative of the economy as a whole doing well, is that reason for most people to say that's good? Okay, because in most cases they don't have very much stock. Okay, the name calling. I will restrain myself here because this could go on a long time, but an awful lot of economic debates end up being, you know, really name-calling. So when we talk about NAFTA, CAFTA, the other trade, invariably, you know, we have the Washington Post tell us on the one side they're the free traders, and on the other side they're protectionists. And that's garbage. It's total, total garbage. Because what those agreements are designed to do is open up some areas for trade. Okay, in particular, what they want to do is make it very easy to trade manufactured goods. Okay, what does that mean? Well, if I'm an auto worker in Michigan, that means they want to put me in competition with auto workers in Malaysia, in Mexico, in China, who work for much, much less money than I do. So that's what they want to do. That's what they mean by free trade. They aren't doing anything to have free trade for doctors and lawyers. You raise that with people, they look at you with blank stares. Well, guess what? Doctors and lawyers earn a lot less in China and India, even if they get the same training as some of them do. Okay, but they don't want free trade for doctors and lawyers. go to whoever your friends are who are big NAFTA supporters or CAFTA supporters. Ask them about, you know, what are the free trade provisions for doctors, and they'll probably look at you like, what on earth are you talking about? They don't want that. What they want are auto workers to work cheap. But they are doctors and lawyers, or their friends are, or their, you know, relatives, or their parents, or kids, or whatever. So these agreements are not about free trade. They want to make manufacturing workers, they want less skilled workers, generally people without college degrees, to have to compete with low-wage labor, you know, in the developing world. They do not want to make people with advanced degrees compete. They're not free traders. Okay. Also, copyrights and patents. This is very important in the scheme of things, because if you look at NAFTA, if you look at CAFTA, a very key part of those agreements and other trade agreements that we've been pushing have been extending copyright and patent protection to developing nations. Okay, these are the opposite of free trade. They're protectionism. Okay, I'll have a segment, the last seminar, our last day seminars, will focus on patents and copyrights, intellectual property rights in general. But, you know, just, I mean, they're called protection, copyright protection, patent protection. It shouldn't have to take too much convincing to you that they're protectionism. Also, just if you think about the size of the protection involved, when you think of, say, getting a CD, if you can get it, you know, downloaded for free, you know, as opposed to spending 12, 14, 15 bucks, whatever they sell it for, or better yet, take software where, you know, Microsoft might look to charge you $100, $200 for software, then principle free. You know, compare that to, you know, the Bush put on tariffs on steel a few years ago, 20%, 30%, and you had all these free traders running around jumping up and down. We can't have tariffs at 20 or 30%. That would be impossible, devastate the economy. But yet, when you talk about, you know, copyright protection for software, they don't say a word. Okay, so allowing them to use these terms, that they're somehow the free traders and we're somehow the protectionists, is totally wrong. It's not true. It suits their purposes because, you know, most people like things that are free. It sounds good. But it's not right. It's, you know, we're giving away the store when we let them frame the debate that way. Okay, double taxation. Okay, this is something that comes up in the contract of the corporate income tax. And again, this is one of the things where, you know, I think we gave away a lot of the store from the word go in the debate. The idea about double taxation, the reason why they said there was double taxation was that profits are taxed when the corporation earns them. We have a corporate income tax. Then, let's say I own shares of stock and the corporation pays out dividends to me. Well, when I get those dividends, I pay taxes on those dividends. So they say it's double taxation. It was taxed once at the corporate level, second time when I get it. That's garbage. Okay, why is it garbage? No one forced them to set up a corporation. Okay, corporate status is a privilege that the government offers to people. Corporate tax is entirely a voluntary tax. Everyone who's paying the corporate tax has decided on their own, they voted with their feet, that the benefits that the government gives them from having a corporation, most importantly, limited liability. I could own stock in Enron, and if they're doing horrible things to people and they go bankrupt, I just lose my stock. They can't take my house. That's because they set up a corporation. Okay, but the benefits of a corporation are worth more than the corporate income tax. And we know that because if it wasn't, they wouldn't do it. They don't have to set up a corporation. And I won't go into my long diatribe about, you know, corporations and, you know, some of the issues that raises. But again, just the point in terms of the debate, there is no issue of double taxation here. The corporate tax is entirely a voluntary one. And if people don't think it's worth their while to have the tax, they could set up a partnership. No one forced them to set up a corporation. Okay, the last one is category takings. This one has just really irked me. I could make a much, much longer list. I'm just sort of picking Dean Baker's highlights here. What's happened with takings is this has come to be a right-wing, you know, crusade that, you know, it's a real outrage if we tell someone that, you know, you can't put up a lodge on your property because it will damage wetlands. The idea is that, you know, I had plans to develop my property, I was going to have the big lodge there, and the big bad government comes in there and tells me I can't do that, so they reduce the value of my property. Okay, well, this is a very weird notion. Why is this unique that, you know, if we have an environmental restriction, it reduces the value of the property, that somehow the government owes me money? Because this comes up in all sorts of other contexts. Okay, suppose the government tells someone else they could develop the wetlands along the coast. Okay, in the case of New Orleans, not accidentalities. Okay, so that increases my probability of having hurricane damage. Or they tell people that they could build levees upstream in the river. Okay, those also increase the likelihood that I'll have damage from bad weather. Is that a taking? Okay, if we're saying it reduces the value of my property, absolutely it's a taking. give you some other examples of takings. Amazon. Amazon doesn't have to pay sales taxes. Don't ask me why, but if you shop at Amazon, you don't have to pay sales taxes. Okay, so if I have the bookstore down the street here, Cramer's, and people go in there and buy books, you have to pay a sales tax. They have to compete with Amazon, where Amazon is, in effect, exempt from sales tax for practical purposes. Okay, so was that a takings from Cramer, that they created this category? You know, internet retailers don't have to pay sales tax. It certainly reduces, you know, the value of their business. Okay, they're going to make less profits because of that. Arguably, that's a taking. Okay, we haven't heard that raised very much, though. The last point, it just, you know, government all the time takes actions that, you know, increase the value of property. If we build a highway so you have good access to your property, we don't expect someone to pay the government back money because, you know, the government has built this highway and now makes their land much more valuable because you can get to and from it, or if you're a farmer, you can easily support your crop. You don't expect people to pay the government. I'm mentioning this because if you go back, there's actually, are people familiar with Robert Posner? Robert Posner is now an appellate court judge. He was appointed by Ronald Reagan. He was a University of Chicago economist. He's sort of the godfather of an area of economics known as law and economics. Very conservative. And if you go back and read what Robert Posner says about takings, he says, get out of here. Okay, what he says about takings is that the government all the time is taking actions that sometimes increase the value of property, sometimes decrease the value of the property. We don't want the courts to deal with that. Take it to the legislatures. The courts don't have time to deal with it. So only in a case where they wreck your, you know, they tell you we're tearing down your home to build, you know, the new stadium, then come to us and get compensation. But short of, you know, pretty much a complete taking, goes, we don't want to see you. It's a very conservative doctrine. So here you had what was being presented as, you know, this free market doctrine. Posner's as free market as you get. Okay, and he tells the people who are upset about takings, get out of here. Don't have a case. Okay, I'm mentioning this just because this was a case where so many environmentalists were put on the defensive for no reason. Okay, there are very good grounds to say, absolutely, sometimes the government does things that will, you know, reduce the property of your land, sometimes the government does things that increase the property of your land, and what Posner says is, intelligent people take that into consideration when they buy the land. Free market doctrine. Okay, last point, just to sum up, the we are right. Okay, I hate being defensive. We rarely have things to be defensive about. We are right. That slide about the 50s and 60s, or I just had the 60s, I've had the 50s, I tell you the same story. The economy, the U.S. economy grew most rapidly in the period where we saw relatively even gains, high and low. So this idea of trickle down, well, we've had trickle down. You know, we had the 80s. We didn't do very well. Not just the people at the bottom didn't do well, but the economy as a whole didn't do very well. And if we want to talk about the late 90s boom, that actually was a period. We had very rapid growth, but we also saw gains up and down the income ladder. So even low-wage workers, even people in the middle of the income distribution, they did very well in the late 90s. So this idea that somehow, you know, first you have to benefit the people at the top and then it's going to trickle down, no, that doesn't fit with the U.S. experience. That's 180 degrees at odds with what the data actually show. Okay, secondly, if we look internationally, you know, who's done best internationally? I know, you know, I've been on, I don't know how many panels, and the right always goes, oh, you want, you know, the high European unemployment. Well, actually, Europe's a very mixed picture. And what you find in Europe is that a lot of the countries that have the lowest unemployment rates, several of them lower unemployment rates than the U.S., obviously this fluctuates, I haven't checked the latest numbers, but, you know, if we look to Denmark, Sweden, Austria, and Ireland, they do have unemployment rates that are very comparable and possibly lower than the U.S., they all have much more equal distributions than the United States does. So this idea that, you know, we simply have to have a choice. We're either going to have, you know, very unequal distribution of income, gross inequality, or, you know, we could have equality, but we'll have no growth, we'll have high unemployment, that's garbage. Okay, the data just doesn't support that. Okay, the last point is just, you know, it's a general principle. We should try and keep arguments as simple as possible. They could hire a lot more economists than we can. I say that, you know, self-defense. I don't know how many areas I've had to work in because there aren't more progressive economists out there. But, you know, in general, these arguments are simple. And I'll just digress a moment to one that was very, very simple and very, very important. Back in the 1990s, there was this big debate over the accuracy of the consumer price index. And price indices are incredibly boring even for economists. But the reason why this was important is that Social Security benefits are indexed to the Consumer Price Index. Some other benefits, food stamps, other benefits are also, but most importantly, Social Security. And what what was going on was there was an effort to cut Social Security benefits by saying the consumer price index overstated inflation by, let's say, 1 percentage point a year, because that was roughly what they said. And therefore, instead of indexing Social Security to the consumer price index, we should index it to the consumer price index minus 1 percentage point. So if the consumer price index says inflation is 3% this year, we'll raise benefits by just 2%. It doesn't seem like a big deal for 1 year, but think about that over 10 years, over 20 years. So you lose 1% this year, 1% next year, 1% the year after. After 10 years, you've lost roughly 10% of your benefits. 20 years, if you stay alive 20 years, you've lost 20%. So it's a big deal. Okay, and they got a group of very prominent economists to all, you know, nod their heads and say, oh yes, this is true. Well, it turned out there was a very, very simple counter-argument. It's just arithmetic. Okay, if it turns out, we don't just use the CPI for indexing Social Security benefits, we use it for everything. Okay, all our measures of income growth, everything. Economic growth, everything. So if it's the case that it's overstating inflation by 1% a year, then wages have been growing by 1% a year more rapidly than we thought. Okay, income's been growing by 1% a year more rapidly than we thought. So I said, okay, well, if this is really true, it didn't just happen. No one said it just happened. It's been going on a long time. Then we could show back, you know, when we were all growing up, or people my age were growing up, we were growing up in poverty. Because if income's growing more rapidly, we know where we are today, we must have started from a lower level. Just arithmetic. There is no way around that. Okay, furthermore, our kids that were supposed to be so worried about, if income's growing more rapidly, they're going to be rich. Okay, well, they had no counter to that. And at the end of the day, this got stopped. A little-known story, Dick Gephardt was the person who stopped it because he refused to go along with it. Clinton had signed on to a deal with the Republicans in Congress. But Dick Gephardt, who was thinking of challenging Al Gore for the 2000 presidential nomination, went along with it. And I don't know Dick Gephardt very well, and I have no idea what he really thought about it, but there's no better issue he could have had in a Democratic primaries against Al Gore than saying, he's the guy who cut your Social Security, and I'm the guy who tried to stop it. Okay, so given those dynamics, Dick Gephardt prevented that from going through. But very often, what you'll find is that the real key to this story is very, very simple. A lot of people want to make it complicated, because as I say, they can hire more economists than we can, but very often it is simple, and we will gain by keeping it simple. So we'll break for, let's say, 5 minutes, and I'm sorry I ran on longer than I wanted to, but we'll break for 5 minutes and then 2 questions.
Thank you.